A manuscript document sent to Scotland Yard by the master of the Emma Jane fishing trawler. From my earliest youth, I realized that my nature was a mass of contradictions. I have, to begin with, an incurably romantic imagination. The practice of throwing a bottle into the sea with an important document inside was one that never failed to thrill me when reading adventure stories as a child. It thrills me still, and for that reason I have adopted this course, writing my confession, enclosing it in a bottle, sealing the letter and casting it into the waves. There is, I suppose, 100-to-1 chance that my confession may be found, and then, or do I flatter myself, a hitherto unsolved murder mystery will be explained. I was born with other traits besides my romantic fancy. I have a definite sadistic delight in seeing or causing death. I remember experiments with wasps, with various garden pests. From an early age, I knew very strongly the lust to kill. But side by side with this went a contradictory trait, a strong sense of justice. It is abhorrent to me that an innocent person or creature should suffer or die by any act of mine. I have always felt strongly that right should prevail. It may be understood, I think a psychologist would understand, that with my mental makeup being what it was, I adopted the law as a profession. The legal profession satisfied nearly all my instincts. Crime and its punishment has always fascinated me. I enjoy reading every kind of detective story and thriller. I have devised for my own private amusement the most ingenious ways of carrying out a murder. When, in due course, I came to preside over a court of law, that other secret instinct of mine was encouraged to develop. To see a wretched criminal squirming in the dock, suffering the tortures of the damned as his doom came slowly and slowly nearer, was to me an exquisite pleasure. Mind you, I took no pleasure in seeing an innocent man there. On at least 2 occasions I stopped cases where, to my mind, the accused was palpably innocent, directing the jury that there was no case. Thanks, however, to the fairness and efficiency of our police force, the majority of the accused persons who have come before me to be tried for murder have been guilty. I will say here that such was the case with the man Edward Seaton. His appearance and manner were misleading, and he created a good impression on the jury. But not only the evidence, which was clear, though unspectacular, but my own knowledge of criminals told me without any doubt that the man had actually committed the crime with which he was charged, the brutal murder of an elderly woman who trusted him. I have a reputation as a hanging judge, but that is unfair. I have always been strictly just and scrupulous in my summing up of a case. All I have done is to protect the jury against the emotional effect of emotional appeals by some of our more emotional counsel. I have drawn their attention to the actual evidence. For some years past, I have been aware of a change within myself, a lessening of control, a desire to act instead of to judge. I have wanted, let me admit it frankly, to commit a murder myself. I recognize this as the desire of the artist to express himself. I was, or could be, an artist in crime. My imagination, sternly checked by the exigencies of my profession, waxed secretly to colossal force. I must commit a murder. And what is more, it must be no ordinary murder. It must be a fantastical crime, something stupendous, out of the common. And in that one respect, I have still, I think, an adolescent's imagination. I wanted something theatrical, impossible. I wanted to kill. Yes, I wanted to kill. But, incongruous as it may seem to some, I was restrained and hampered by my innate sense of justice. The innocent must not suffer. And then, quite suddenly, the idea came to me. Started by a chance remark uttered during casual conversation. It was a doctor to whom I was talking, some ordinary, undistinguished GP. He mentioned casually how often murder must be committed, which the law was unable to touch. And he instanced a particular case, that of an old lady, a patient of his who had recently died. He was, he said, himself convinced that her death was due to the withholding of a restorative drug by a married couple who attended on her and who stood to benefit very substantially by her death. That sort of thing, he explained, was quite impossible to prove. But he was nevertheless quite sure of it in his own mind. He added that there were many cases of a similar nature going on all the time. Cases of deliberate murder, and all quite untouchable by the law. That was the beginning of the whole thing. I suddenly saw my way clear, and I determined to commit not one murder, but murder on a grand scale. A childish rhyme of my infancy came back into my mind, the rhyme of the 10 little soldier boys. It had fascinated me as a child of 2, the inexorable diminishment, the sense of inevitability. I began secretly to collect victims. I will not take up space here by going into details of how this was accomplished. I had a certain routine line of conversation which I employed with nearly everyone I met, and the results I got were really surprising. During the time I was in a nursing home, I collected the case of Dr. Armstrong, a violently teetotal sister who attended on me, being anxious to prove to me the evils of drink by recounting to me a case many years ago in hospital when a doctor under the influence of alcohol had killed a patient on whom he was operating. A careless question as to where the sister in question had trained, etc., soon gave me the necessary data. I tracked down the doctor and the patient mentioned without difficulty. A conversation between 2 old military gossips in my club put me on the track of General MacArthur. A man who had recently returned from the Amazon gave me a devastating resume of the activities of one Philip Lombard. An indignant Mem Sahib in Mallorca recounted the tale of the Puritan Emily Brent and her wretched servant girl. Anthony Marston I selected from a large group of people who had committed similar offences. His complete callousness and his inability to feel any responsibility for the lives he had taken made him, I considered, a type dangerous to the community and unfit to live. Ex-Inspector Blaw came my way quite naturally. Some of my professional brethren discussing the Lander case with freedom and vigor. I took a serious view of his offense. The police, as servants of the law, must be of a high order of integrity, for their word is perforce believed by virtue of their profession. Finally, there was the case of Vera Claythorne. It was when I was crossing the Atlantic. At a late hour one night, the sole occupants of the smoking room were myself and a good-looking young man named Hugo Hamilton. Hugo Hamilton was unhappy. To assuage that unhappiness, he had taken a considerable quantity of drink. He was in the maudlin confidential stage. Without much hope of any result, I automatically started my routine conversational gambit. The response was startling. I can remember his words now. He said, "You're right. Murder isn't what most people think. Giving someone a dollop of arsenic, pushing them over a cliff, that sort of stuff." He leaned forward, thrusting his face into mine. He said, "I've known a murderess. Known her, I tell you. And what's more, I was crazy about her. God help me, sometimes I think I still am. It's hell, I tell you, hell. You see, she did it more or less for me. Not that I ever dreamed. Women are fiends, absolute fiends. You wouldn't think a girl like that, a nice, straight, jolly girl, you wouldn't think she'd do it, would you? That she'd take a kid out to sea and let it drown. You wouldn't think a woman could do a thing like that." I said to him, "Are you sure she did do it?" He said, and in saying it, he seemed suddenly to sober up. "I am quite sure. Nobody else ever thought of it. But I knew the moment I looked at her when I got back after, and she knew I knew. What she didn't realize was that I loved that kid." He didn't say any more, but it was easy enough for me to trace back the story and reconstruct it. I needed a tenth victim. I found him in a man named Morris. He was a shady little creature. Amongst other things, he was a dope peddler, and he was responsible for inducing the daughter of friends of mine to take to drugs. She committed suicide at the age of 21. During all this time of search, my plan had been gradually maturing in my mind. It was now complete, and the coping stone to it was an interview I had with a doctor in Harley Street. I have mentioned that I underwent an operation. My interview in Harley Street told me that another operation would be useless. My medical adviser wrapped up the information very prettily, but I am accustomed to getting at the truth of a statement. I did not tell the doctor of my decision. That my death should not be as slow and protracted one as it would be in the course of nature. No, my death should take place in a blaze of excitement. I would live before I died. And now to the actual mechanics of the crime of Soldier Island. To acquire the island using the man Morris to cover my tracks was easy enough. He was an expert in that sort of thing. Tabulating the information I had collected about my prospective victims, I was able to concoct a suitable bait for each. None of my plans miscarried. All my guests arrived at Soldier Island on the 8th of August. The party included myself. Morris was already accounted for. He suffered from indigestion. Before leaving London, I gave him a capsule to take last thing at night, which had, I said, done wonders for my own gastric juices. He accepted unhesitatingly. The man was a slight hypochondriac. I had no fear that he would leave any compromising documents or memoranda behind. He was not that sort of man. The order of death upon the island had been subjected by me to special thought and care. There were, I considered, amongst my guests varying degrees of guilt. Those whose guilt was the lightest should, I decided, pass out first and not suffer the prolonged mental strain and fear that the more cold-blooded offenders were to suffer. Anthony Marston and Mrs. Rogers died first, the one instantaneously, the other in a peaceful sleep. Marston, I recognized, was a type born without that feeling of moral responsibility which most of us have. He was amoral, pagan. Mrs. Rogers, I had no doubt, had acted very largely under the influence of her husband. I need not describe closely how those two met their deaths. The police will have been able to work that out quite easily. Potassium cyanide is easily obtained by householders for putting down wasps. I had some in my possession, and it was easy to slip it into Marston's almost empty glass during the tense period after the gramophone recital. I may say that I watched the faces of my guests closely during that indictment, and I had no doubt whatever, after my long court experience, that one and all were guilty. During recent bouts of pain, I had been ordered a sleeping draught, chloral hydrate. It had been easy for me to suppress this until I had a lethal amount in my possession. When Rogers brought up some brandy for his wife, he set it down on a table, and in passing that table I put the stuff into the brandy. It was easy, for at that time suspicion had not begun to set in. General MacArthur met his death quite painlessly. He did not hear me come up behind him. I had, of course, to choose my time for leaving the terrace very carefully, but everything was successful. As I had anticipated, a search was made of the island, and it was discovered that there was no one on it but our seven selves. That at once created an atmosphere of suspicion. According to my plan, I should shortly need an ally. I selected Dr. Armstrong for that part. He was a gullible sort of man. He knew me by sight and reputation, and it was inconceivable to him that a man of my standing should actually be a murderer. All his suspicions were directed against Lombard, and I pretended to concur in these. I hinted to him that I had a scheme by which it might be possible to trap the murderer into incriminating himself. Though a search had been made of everyone's room, no search as yet had been made of the persons themselves, but that was bound to come soon. I killed Rogers on the morning of August 10th. He was chopping sticks for lighting the fire and did not hear me approach. I found the key to the dining room door in his pocket. He had locked it the night before. In the confusion attending the finding of Roger's body, I slipped into Lombard's room and abstracted his revolver. I knew that he would have one with him. In fact, I had instructed Morris to suggest as much when he interviewed him. At breakfast, I slipped my last dose of chloral into Miss Brent's coffee when I was refilling her cup. We left her in the dining room. I slipped in there a little while later. She was nearly unconscious, and it was easy to inject a strong solution of cyanide into her. The bumblebee business was really rather childish, but somehow, you know, it pleased me. I liked adhering as closely as possible to my nursery rhyme. Immediately after this, what I had already foreseen happened. Indeed, I believe I suggested it myself. We all submitted to a rigorous search. I had safely hidden away the revolver and had no more cyanide or chloral in my possession. It was then that I intimated to Armstrong that we must carry our plan into effect. It was simply this. I must appear to be the next victim. That would perhaps rattle the murderer. At any rate, once I was supposed to be dead, I could move about the house and spy upon the unknown murderer. Armstrong was keen on the idea. We carried it out that evening. A little plaster of red mud on the forehead, the red curtain and the wool and the stage was set. The lights of the candles were very flickering and uncertain, and the only person who would examine me closely was Armstrong. It worked perfectly. Miss Claythorne screamed the house down when she found the seaweed which I had thoughtfully arranged in her room. They all rushed up, and I took up my pose of a murdered man. The effect on them when they found me was all that could be desired. Armstrong acted his part in the most professional manner. They carried me upstairs and laid me on my bed. Nobody worried about me. They were all too deadly scared and terrified of each other. I had a rendezvous with Armstrong outside the house at 1:45. I took him up a little way behind the house on the edge of the cliff. I said that here we could see if anyone else approached us, and we should not be seen from the house as the bedrooms faced the other way. He was still quite unsuspicious, and yet he ought to have been warned. If he had only remembered the words of the nursery rhyme, "A red herring swallowed one." He took the red herring all right. It was quite easy. I uttered an exclamation, leant over the cliff, told him to look. Wasn't that the mouth of a cave? He leant right over. A quick, vigorous push sent him off his balance and splash into the heaving sea below. I returned to the house. It must have been my footfall that Blore heard. A few minutes after I had returned to Armstrong's room, I left it, this time making a certain amount of noise so that someone should hear me. I heard a door open as I got to the bottom of the stairs. They must have just glimpsed my figure as I went out of the front door. It was a minute or two before they followed me. I had gone straight round the house and in at the dining-room window, which I had left open. I shut the window, and later I broke the glass. Then I went upstairs and laid myself out again on my bed. I calculated that they would search the house again, but I did not think that they would look closely at any of the corpses. A mere twitch aside of the sheet to satisfy themselves that it was not Armstrong masquerading as a body. This is exactly what occurred. I forgot to say that I returned the revolver to Lombard's room. It may be of interest to someone to know where it was hidden during the search. There was a big pile of tinned food in the larder. I opened the bottommost of the tins, biscuits, I think it contained, bedded in the revolver, and replaced the strip of adhesive tape. I calculated, and rightly, that no one would think of working their way through a pile of apparently untouched foodstuffs, especially as all the top tins were soldered. The red curtain I had concealed by laying it flat on the seat of one of the drawing-room chairs under the chintz cover and the wool in the seat cushion, cutting a small hole. And now came the moment that I had anticipated. Three people who were so frightened of each other that anything might happen, and one of them had a revolver. I watched them from the windows of the house. When Blore came up alone, I had the big marble clock poised ready. Exit Blore. From my window I saw Vera Claythorne shoot Lombard, a daring and resourceful young woman. I always thought she was a match for him and more. As soon as that had happened, I set the stage in her bedroom. It was an interesting psychological experiment. Would the consciousness of her own guilt, the state of nervous tension consequent on having just shot a man, be sufficient, together with the hypnotic suggestion of the surroundings, to cause her to take her own life? I thought it would. I was right. Vera Claythorne hanged herself before my eyes where I stood in the shadow of the wardrobe. And now for the last stage. I came forward, picked up the chair, and set it against the wall. I looked for the revolver and found it at the top of the stairs where the girl had dropped it. I was careful to preserve her fingerprints on it. And now I shall finish writing this. I shall enclose it and seal it in a bottle, and I shall throw the bottle into the sea. Why? Yes, why? It was my ambition to invent a murder mystery that no one could solve. But no artist, I now realize, can be satisfied with art alone. There is a natural craving for recognition which cannot be gainsaid. I have, let me confess it in all humility, a pitiful human wish that someone should know just how clever I have been. In all this, I have assumed that the mystery of Soldier Island will remain unsolved. It may be, of course, that the police will be cleverer than I think. There are, after all, three clues. One, the police are perfectly aware that Edward Seaton was guilty. They know, therefore, that one of the 10 people on the island was not a murderer in any sense of the word, and it follows, paradoxically, that that person must logically be the murderer. The second clue lies in the 7th verse of the nursery rhyme. Armstrong's death is associated with a red herring which he swallowed, or rather which resulted in swallowing him. That is to say that at that stage of the affair, some hocus-pocus is clearly indicated, and that Armstrong was deceived by it and sent to his death. That might start a promising line of inquiry, for at that period there are only 4 persons, and of those 4, I am clearly the only one likely to inspire him with confidence. The third is symbolical. The manner of my death marking me on the forehead, the brand of Cain. There is, I think, little more to say. After entrusting my bottle and its message to the sea, I shall go to my room and lay myself down on the bed. To my eyeglasses is attached what seems a length of fine black cord, but it is elastic cord. I shall lay the weight of the body on the glasses. The cord I shall loop round the door handle and attach it, not too solidly, to the revolver. And what I think will happen is this. My hand, protected with a handkerchief, will press the trigger. My hand will fall to my side. The revolver, pulled by the elastic, will recoil to the door. Jarred by the door handle, it will detach itself from the elastic and fall. The elastic, released, will hang down innocently from the eyeglasses on which my body is lying. A handkerchief lying on the floor will cause no comment whatever. I shall be found, laid neatly on my bed, shot through the forehead in accordance with the record kept by my fellow victims. Times of death cannot be stated with any accuracy by the time our bodies are examined. When the sea goes down, there will come from the mainland boats and men. and they will find 10 dead bodies and an unsolved problem on Soldier Island. Signed, Lawrence Wargrave. This is Dan Stevens. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. This program was directed and produced by Karen Jakonski, engineered by Zane Birdwell and Nathan Rossborough, with music by Zane Birdwell. Post-production by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 1939, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 2013 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.